Coming up next from the Grassy Knoll, a terrifying look into the Orwellian world of brainwashing, disinformation, and ultimately, control over you. You. You're listening to Dade City Community Radio from the Grassy Knoll. I'm Dr. Swain.
Did you have to think about that?
I had to think about it. It's Friday.
Oh, this will be a good show.
And the last show we talked about the upcoming war in Iraq.
A war with Iraq?
Yeah, the one where the real Visigoths, is leading us down the path toward nuclear war. And we're going to get sucked into a vortex. You're going to talk about some strange things that kind of go back on some of the things we were talking about.
Yeah, there's two shows about Bohemian Grove and Luciferianism. And I want to clear something up, talking about Moloch and where that appeared in the Old Testament. Yahweh did give an adjuration to Moses not to mess with sacrifices to Moloch. But what I was thinking about, the reference to Moloch, was in Jeremiah 32:35. This is the King James Version. And they built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the sons of Hinnom, to cause their sons and daughters to pass through the fire unto Moloch. Now listen to that phrase. To cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire unto Moloch. That's child sacrifice. Which I commanded them not. Neither came it into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. So when we were talking about the stone owl of Moloch at Bohemian Grove, that's representative of an idol always associated with child sacrifice.
Now, who was the I in that story? Was that Moses?
Yahweh. That's the unspeakable name. He was talking... Probably through Jeremiah.
Oh, okay.
Jeremiah the prophet who used to always...
I'm with you.
You got that? Okay, I'm sorry about that.
So God commanded...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he told him, you don't do that. Of all things, you don't do that.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. I don't think I would need God to tell me that you don't sacrifice children.
But because children are dear to the Lord, they are just as much prized by Satan. And referring to that, there's some notions about the value of human sacrifice to occult societies. In his book Magic, that's spelled M-A-G-I-C-K, Aleister Crowley noted that the highest spiritual working required the sacrifice of a male child. And this is from his book. It is necessary for us to consider carefully the problems connected with the bloody sacrifice. The bloody sacrifice has from time immemorial been the most considered part of magic. It would be unwise to condemn as irrational the practice of those savages who tear the heart and liver from an adversary and devour them while yet warm. In any case, it was the theory of ancient magicians that any living being is a storehouse of energy. At the death of the animal, this energy is liberated suddenly. The animal should therefore be killed within the circle, or the triangle, as the case may be, so that its energy cannot escape. For the highest spiritual working, one must accordingly choose that victim which contains the greatest and purest force. Sound like a virgin to you, perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
All right. A male child of perfect innocence and high intelligence is the most satisfactory and suitable victim. Those magicians who object to the use of blood have endeavored to replace it with incense.
Ooh.
But the bloody sacrifice, though more dangerous, is more efficacious, and for nearly all purposes, human sacrifice is the best. The method of killing is practically uniform. The animal should be stabbed to the heart or its throat, severed in either case by the knife. And I don't think he's referring to animals whatsoever. All right, we'll give him the credit of the doubt, though he's a lion sack of crap. In 1966, do you remember this person, Dr. Swain? Anton LaVey.
He's the
founder,
Grand Wizard of the First Church of Satan or something
in San Francisco.
California.
Right. Like Crowley, LaVey took a very strong stand against Christianity. That's a surprise. He tries to downplay the idea of human sacrifice by Satanists. He, in fact, claims that they would not want to sacrifice a baby.
But they would sacrifice something else.
It's what you don't say, perhaps, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
Al Carlisle, a Utah State prison psychologist, and there's been an awful lot of human sacrifices reported to have been taking place in Utah. Carlisle does not agree with the statement that Satanists would not sacrifice any animal or baby. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, August 3, 1986, Carlisle said, "Individuals who are at the cult level have no qualms about killing others. I know one guy who witnessed a dozen sacrifices back east. He said, they believe the prime energy in a person is in the blood. They sacrifice the person and believe that those who consume the blood will receive the power."
Now stop right there.
Sure.
Isn't there an old gospel hymn that people used to sing?
The blood?
The power in the blood.
Yeah. But that's a different metaphor.
But metaphor, nevertheless, think about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can listen, no problem. I can understand the power of the blood, because apparently there is, for whatever purposes. But when they talk about that, they're talking about the blood of Christ.
Well, I keep in mind, too, that Satanism is like Christianity turned inside out. Okay. So, you know, that's where I'm going with that. You know,
smile is just a frown, turn upside down.
Yeah, well, ooh, really. Upside down pipe.
Yeah. Finally, if I can go on,
yes.
Dr. Susan J. Kelly observed that although devil worship has existed as long as Christianity, modern Satanism began as an occult revival in the last century. Because Christianity believes that children are special to God, there you go, Satanism, which negates Christianity, considers the desecration of children to be a way of gaining victory over God. And as we had said before, that this bit about human sacrifice, the abduction of children, is a pandemic problem, one not just confined to, some dark hinterlands in another continent. It's in the United States, it's in Europe, it's everywhere. It is a global business. Now, moving right along to the secret societies, remember we refer to, I'm really going to have to call it by its true pronunciation, the Thule Society.
Okay.
That's kind of girly sounding for a Nordic Germanic.
The Thule, you know. Thule sounds.
I like Thule.
Yeah, yeah.
This comes from geocities.com/countermedia.html.
Is this another? Do we have that posted?
It's on.
Okay.
It's up there. You got it. Formed toward the end of World War I as an offshoot of the Germanin Order, the Thule Society quickly grew into the most powerful secret organization in Germany. One of its most influential and shadowy leaders, Baron Rudolf von Sambatendorf, portrayed the Thule Society as the custodian of an ancient wisdom perverted by Freemasonry. Perverted by Freemasonry. The old Freemasonry, wrote Rudolph, had been a keeper of the secrets which they had learned from the Aryan wisdom and from the alchemists. An article in the July 21, 1918 edition of the Society's journal, Runen, Rudolph gives the view on the antithesis between modern Freemasonry and the Thule Society. Quote, he said, "We look at our world as a product of the people. The Freemason looks at it as a product of conditions," unquote. In 1910, while living in Istanbul, old Rudy got around. He founded his own secret society based on a combination of his Islamic Sufi mysticism, masonry, alchemy, and anti-Bolshevik ideology. He fought heroically in the Balkan War of 1912 and directed the Turkish Red Crescent. He was also named Master of the Order of Rose Garland, Rosencrantz. There you go, Dr. Swain. Years later, he titled his autobiographical novel Der Talisman des Rosenkreuzers. The Rosicrucian Talisman. We have something about them down the road.
These are the guys in California. Everything's in California.
It's not California. It's in Turkey.
Well, I'm saying the Rosicrucians in the United States are stuck in.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
very
California.
Good. That's probably one of the most active chapters. I wonder if they sponsor like Little League teams and stuff.
The ones
On August 17, 1918, the Thule Society was founded in Bavaria. Bavaria's just a hot bit for these guys, huh? Adam's home, old white shop. Close to two decades later, Rudy Sambatendorf wrote of this event, "This decision was important for Bavaria, has thereby become the cradle of the National Socialist Movement, which would become the Nazi Party. By November of that year, the Thule Society had 1,500 active members. On Saturday, November 9th, as revolution swept Germany and the old imperial order collapsed, Rudy addressed the leaders of the Thule. Yesterday, we experienced the collapse of everything which was familiar, dear, and valuable to us. What will come out of this chaos, very key word there, we do not know yet, but we can guess. A time will come of struggle, the most bitter need, a time of danger. Significantly, he closes his impassioned speech by exhorting Thule members to fight until the swastika rises victoriously out of the icy darkness, the old fire and ice motif. Thule quickly became the focal point for the anti-communist and national struggle across Germany. Adolf Hitler was not a member of the Thule and would not join the fledgling German Workers' Party until late 1919. Alfred Rosenberg and Rudolf Hess were active Thulists, both going on to high positions in the Third Reich.
Okay, I'm confused. Alan Rosenberg?
Yeah.
In the Third Reich.
Yeah, I know. How does that... Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how that worked out. We have to check on old Alfred.
Is he a friend of... Is he a doctor or something? Yeah, or... I don't know.
He might have been a lawyer.
It could be.
Okay. All right, outwardly, the Thule Society passes a literary circle. Now, can you imagine these guys walking into a library with glasses and books and trying to pass for, like, academia?
Yeah.
You know? Nah, come on, guys. A literary circle devoted to studying ancient German history and customs. Its name derived from the mythological land of the north, the ancient Ultima Thule. And we remember talking about how they was that supposed kingdom to the farthest north extremes of the globe. From CephasMinistry.com, and that's also up there, just these two items. The Thule Society believed in communication with a hierarchy of supermen, which in German would be called the Übermann, the secret chiefs of the Third Order. The quality which makes these beings supermen was occultic spirituality. Further, they believed in Madame Blavatsky's, old Madame B, her secret doctrine, which teaches that certain supermen had survived the destruction of Atlantis with their higher levels of consciousness intact. These supermen were Aryans. These two beliefs combined into one through the Thule Society and Hitler, culminating in the Nazi death camps. When one group of people incorporate into their spiritual belief structure that they are inherently superior to another group of people, it is inevitable that genocide will be attempted as soon as possible. That's a pretty heavy statement.
That's pretty much where we're at right now again.
Yeah, I mean...
If you think about it, if you watch what's going on, we're at that point where there's a group of people better than everybody else, and we're going to take care of the...
And, of course, there has to be another group that's going to be subservient. And at this point, under the guise of war, this could be seen as a genocide of the Arab people. The Thule Society regularly held occult seances, during which time they communicated with demons who were either masquerading as a dead person or who just were appearing as their guiding spirits. Dietrich Eckhart, who we spoke about before, Alfred Rosenberg, there he goes again, and Adolf invoked the Antichrist into manifestation at the mediumistic seances of the Thule group in Munich. Once training was completed, Hitler believed he was born anew with that super personal strength and resolution he would need to fulfill the mandate ordained for him. Hitler literally equated this with the Christian claim to be born again from the studies with the Thule Society. And there are people, I believe, if I got this correct, that Rosio in his book, Hitler and the New Age, and I think he quoted Spengler as saying that he didn't understand how Adolf did it. I mean, he looked at Adolf, he was a twerp. You know, he was gaseous, as you know, his famous flatulence.
Yeah.
And I mean, how could this guy lead that country to the extremes that they went?
His dietary habits were very similar to yours, as a matter of fact. I didn't want to bring that up.
Oh, he was a vegan?
Yeah, he didn't eat meat, didn't do any of those things, and I'm still convinced that had he had a glass of wine and some lamb or something at night, the whole outcome of the world would probably be a lot different.
However, I do not share in his rather poor hygiene.
Did he have poor hygiene?
You did not want to be in an elevator stuck with that guy.
Oh, okay.
And just one other thing, the symbol, the swastika, the Nazi swastika, comes from one of mankind's oldest symbols. It is shown on pottery fragments from Greece, dating back to the 8th century BC. It was used in ancient Egypt, India, and China. The Navajo Indians of North America have a traditional swastika pattern. Arab Islamic sorcerers used it. In more recent times, it was incorporated in the flags of certain Baltic states. The idea for the use of the swastika by the Nazis came from a dentist named Dr. Friedrich Krohn, I don't know, who was a member of the secret Germanic order. Krohn produced the design for the actual form in which the Nazis came to use the symbol. It's a reversal. It's a spinning anti-clockwise of the sun. What was it? The sun? Give me help here. The sun wheel.
Yeah.
Okay. As a solar symbol, the swastika is properly thought of as spinning, and the Buddhists have always believed the symbol attracted luck. The Sanskrit word svastika means good fortune and well-being. But according to Kabbalistic lore and occult theory, chaotic forces can be evoked by reversing the symbol. And so the symbol appeared on the flag of Nazi Germany and the insignia of the Nazi Party, an indication for those who had eyes to see as to the occult nature of the Third Reich. Now, moving on, Skull and Bones.
Now, this is something that I'm pretty familiar with because it's an organization that's tangled up with some fraternities and universities, great American universities. And if I'm not, you know, incorrect, I believe that our current president is a member of the Skull and Bones, and I think his dad was, too.
There you go, and I think you go back one more generation.
Can't be all that. There's a lot of people who are Skull and Bones.
It's in Yale.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
The Skull and Bones incorporates in sexual activities into their practices. The death of the initiate will be as frightful as the use of human skeletons and rituals as the use of human skeletons and ritual psychology can make it. And some wonder just how ritualistic it is. The Skull and Bones believes that on the night of initiation, the initiate dies to the world and be born again into the order. Again, another one of these death, resurrection.
And the reversal.
Right, again. One of the most sobering facets of this counterfeit born-again initiation ritual is the initiate swears to an allegiance to the secret order that transcends any allegiance later in life. Now, remember that. Okay? Secret order transcends everything that would come afterward. Christian author, the late Bill Cooper, captures this disturbing fact most succinctly. And this is...
So what if you're struck with a sudden impulse to be saved? You don't get saved
by
the Almighty, and you don't worry about getting saved because you have an allegiance to the Skull and Bones.
They could not coexist together.
Yeah, okay.
And so since our buddy Georgie,
he's a Christian,
born again Christian, and is a member of Skull and Bones.
Of course, he said he was born again. He didn't say he was a born again Christian.
Very good. This comes from Cooper's "Behold a Pale Horse." Members of the order take an oath that absolves them from any allegiances to any nation or king or government or constitution, and that includes the negating of any subsequent oath which they may be required to take. They swear allegiance only to the order and its goal of a new world order. According to the oath Bush took when he was initiated into Skull and Bones, his oath of office as a president of the United States means nothing. And this is a reference to King George I. We're going to talk about Ron Rosenbaum a little bit later because he actually got on top of a rooftop there in New Haven, Connecticut, and with night vision cameras caught one of their initiation ceremonies. He also discovered documents which detailed the origins of Bones back to Germany. And here's the key here. These documents stated, Bones is a chapter of a core of a German university. The document described at length its relationship with this German secret society. Guess which one? The Thule Society, which led to the founding of the Skull and Bones in 1832, and it's an elitist group. I mean, you've got
now,
to be somebody.
Now, the Skull and Bones also exists at other universities throughout the world, am I correct? Didn't Oxford...
Yeah. I would think that there's...
There's like a British connection, because somewhere along the line, I think the Prime Minister of Great Britain is a Skull and Bones guy. Could be wrong.
Hey, you've seen one secret society.
Them all. But I think Tony Blair is a Skull and Bones guy.
The New York Observer, and they have a website, www.observer.com. This Ron Rosenbaum, as I said, got on a rooftop with a camera crew, and they filmed an initiation. Article was posted on April 25th, 2002. We're not talking about this is the real George W., although sometimes he wondered because of the accent. This could be an alum more or less coming back. But it stated, it's the primal scene of American power, of Bush family values. For two centuries, the initiation rite of Skull and Bones has shaped the character of the men who have shaped the American character, including two presidents named Bush. So I guess Prescott wasn't involved in that. And last Saturday, which was April 14th, 2002, for the first time ever, that long secret rite was witnessed by a team of outsiders, including this writer. Using high-tech night vision video equipment, able to peer through the gloom into the inner courtyard of the Skull and Bones tomb in New Haven, the Observer team witnessed, 1. The George W. effect. Intoxicated by renewed proximity to presidential power, a robed bonesman posing as George W. harangued initiates in an eerily accurate Texas drawl. I'm going to ream you like I reamed Al Gore. and I'm going to kill you like I killed Al Gore. Loving. Number two, privileged Skull and Bones members mocked the assault on Abner Louima, who you might remember was abused by New York City police.
This is the broom handle, okay?
Close.
Yeah.
They mocked him by crying out repeatedly, "Take that plunger out of my ass."
Yeah.
Skull and Bones member hurled obscene sexual insults such as "lick my bumhole" at initiates as they were forced to kneel and kiss a skull at the feet of the initiators. Other members acted out the tableau of a throat-cutting ritual murder. There you go, with the sacrifice, the blood, the whole nine yards. Of course, there's more to Skull and Bones than this mystical mumbo-jumbo of its rituals. The rituals are less important than the relationships, the bonds of power and influence that develop between Skull and Bones initiates after they graduate. But the relationships are first forged by the rituals, and the fact that the founders of Time Incorporated and the CIA, as well as several secretaries of state and national security advisors, the men who made the decision to drop the Hiroshima bomb, invade the Bay of Pigs, and plunge U.S. into the Vietnam, the Tafts, the Bundys, the Buckleys, the Harrimans, the Lovitz, all took part in this initiation ritual, and it may have something to do with the real-world power of those bonds, those unspoken understandings, the comfort level with the clandestine, and the nods and winks with which power is exercised.
Well, they give them a few bucks, too, before they get out of school, you know, get out of school and start them off.
I would think so.
Yeah, I hear this, but there's a lot of bizarre things that go on in organizations, you know, fraternities, you know, they do
really?
So. I mean, I've seen Animal House.
Times, what?
Of course, it was a little ripped.
I was going to say, like, cubed.
Yeah, yeah.
Not squared.
But they also, you know, one thing we haven't brought out in all fairness to Skull and Bones is that they also offer an opportunity for these people to decline being members.
Well, I mean, do you want to work for $25,000? I mean, if you're a young graduate.
What is that supposed to be? You trying to be funny?
Well, we're in Florida.
Yeah, right.
We'd be rolling and
but I think they give them something like $50,000 when they leave school. Mysteriously, it's deposited in an account.
And
the people, I mean, every person that is a Skull and Bones person when he graduates from Yale will have an account opened up at some bank in his name, and mysteriously there's $50,000 in that thing. That's not too bad.
Well, with the Skull and Bones, obviously there's a death motif as well with this coffin. And you think back to when we spoke about the tale of Osiris and of his death and the coffin and the placing in the acacia tree. It's all, you know, it's all got its roots in Satanism. But let me just read to you what was captured on video and on audio with what took place at this viewing of the initiation.
Let me ask you one thing.
Yeah.
It whacks a little bit. If it wasn't rooted in something as bizarre as Satanism, there wouldn't be much fun doing it now, would there? I mean,
from your mouth, that proceeded.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you know what I'm saying. You got to remember, it's like Halloween.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead. Go ahead.
All right. This is what takes place. One of the initiates called out Uncle Toby, and in parentheses, it says many bone ritual persona are taken from Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy. You got to give them their credit there for good taste. Uncle Toby, the cried repeated. Shut up, neophyte. Take that plunger out of my ass, Uncle Toby. Presumably this mocking Louima reference was a ploy to scare initiates into thinking Uncle Toby was going to give them the plunger treatment. The cheerful rectal theme was followed up by, I'm going to ream you like I reamed Al Gore. Followed by, help me, it's the devil. And then, George W., really getting into it. I'm going to kill you like I killed Al Gore. Then silence. Then a door opened. Voices, half of them it seemed, women, were screaming, run, neophyte, run, neophyte. The neophytes are, of course, the new initiates. From my post, and this is Rosenberg writing, I could only see hooded figures racing about in the darkness above my head, accompanied by cries of, run, neophyte, find the femur, and again, take that plunger out of my ass, Uncle Toby. Now, he says he's below it. He may have been in the subterranean room filming up, or the crew
itself
was on the roof. But anyway, then silence for a while. The neophytes seem to have gone back inside the tomb, after which one of the patriarchs complained, well, you ought to get better blood than this fucking syrup, man. It was only later that I learned what the blood was for, the whole throat-slitting barbarian tableau after the skull kissing. But first there was a different kind of kissing being referred to. There were cries of, lick my bumhole, neophyte. Lick my ass, neophyte. Do you like my bum, neophyte? Despite these heartfelt pleas, we did not witness any of those acts being consummated. The bumhole tribute was followed by more cries of, "Get the femur!" And at last part of the death mantra I'd heard before, "Death equals death." Following which, and this is a little graphic, the supposed George W. chimed in with, "I'm president of the motherfucking USA," apparently just for the sheer pleasure of saying it. He was sounding more like the real George all the time. It began to be clear that what was going on outside in the courtyard was the climax of an initiation ceremony that began inside the tomb. There, it's reputed, the initiates must first enter into the coffin and die to the barbarian world, to the world of savages, all but skull and bones elect, in order to be reborn as a member of the order. Then comes the skull kissing and the throat slashing. And finally, 2 hours later, after all 15 of the initiates had burst out to be harangued and scared, I approached the rendezvous point with the night vision camera team. So they were elevated.
Okay.
This was the moment of truth. The night vision team wasn't sure what their digicams had picked up. With their own eyes, they'd gotten evocative glimpses, but the payback on the camera swing out view screens would be the first time, so far as we knew, any outsider had really seen the legendary ritual. A ritual three presidents, a few Supreme Court justices, maybe a dozen senators, including John Kerry, which would mean a head-to-head, skull-to-skull smackdown with George W. Several secretaries of state were involved in this. Literary and cultural luminaries, including John Hersey and William F. Buckley, had all undergone this. A shrill, menacing, and sometimes blood-curdling chorus of cries and screams and imprecations accompanied the emergence, "Hurry, neophyte! Run, neophyte! Find a femur, neophyte," along with the occasional "lick my bumhole, remove the plunger," and these type outcries.
Sick stuff.
Yeah, and then he just says in the end, "I'm not sure what it all means. I've yet to decode the mystical significance of this, although I do love to think of the former President Bush kissing the skull." Obviously, it has something to do with the subservience. Kiss the skull of power. Bow down to the order. But what about the barbarian cutting the throat of the victim? Does it mean one dies to the barbarian world? Does it mean death to the barbarians? Does it endorse cutthroat activities? Is that how they enforce silence and secrecy? And he leaves us with that.
Some strange, and this is stuff that's going on. How is this? This is probably a once a year event, I'm guessing.
Yeah, every year it's like a big
party,
You have some new people coming
in. You don't really think the president takes time out of his schedule to go down there? Probably not.
No, I think I think Rosenbaum just kind of.
You could get a Paul Lynde guy there, somebody to go down there, and
I don't think Paul would go over real
no.
well.
No, okay.
I mean, one that he's dead in 2 years.
Yeah, that's true.
He's up the persuasion.
That's true.
Well, we'll leave it there, but we'll pick it up with some more occult societies in our next show. We're not doing this for the salaciousness of it, but because to let you know.
What the heck
this kind
is
of
going
stuff
on?
Exists out there, and it's just under the.
It's too fantastic for most people to believe, and that's why that's why they do it.
And we bring it up also because of this bit about lost children, the milk carton children,
yeah.
And this whole bit about using them as.
I was talking to the Visigoth earlier today, and I would encourage people from a non-entertainment perspective, but from a critique perspective, to take another look at Eyes Wide Shut and analyze what's going on in that film and analyze the fact that, first of all, you had a bizarre movie producer to start with and writer was Stanley Kubrick. I never get it right. And everything, from the first movie I ever saw he did was Clockwork Orange, so it was on the edge. So at any rate, we're out of here.
Check that out.
Check us out at the website www.pascalradio.org. From the Grassy Knoll is a production of Dade City Community Radio. This program highlights pertinent issues deliberately not reported by our managed information service. You are encouraged to rebroadcast this show on local grassroots, non-commercial stations. Also, you are invited to comment on this and other programs by emailing us at dcmicroradio@aol.com. For Dade City Community Radio, I'm Dr. Swain.